Now I talk about quantum dots. I realized after yesterday that I should probably spend some time on telling some of the computer scientists about physics that may not be so obvious. So for the benefit of clarity, I've decided to skip the quantum dots part. However, let's talk physics. This is a very bad image of an ion trap experiment. Those of you in the back may just be able to make out the two ion isotopes here and here, which don't show up very well in this picture. But basically what you're seeing here is a string of 40 or so mercury ions trapped in a so-called linear Paul trap. And what they're doing is they're fluorescing, which means they're emitting photons, which you can collect in a photodetector and thus observe them. This is a highly non-trivial feat, the ability to just trap so many ions in a little trap at distances of approximately 10 microns or so separating the ions. This has only been accomplished in the past 10 years or so. And there are very few experimental groups in the world that can do this. And miraculously, this system turns out to be extremely useful for the purposes of quantum computing, an observation which was made by Schirach and Zoller in a very famous paper published in 1995. What you're actually seeing there, these ions, they are trapped in something that looks like this. Again, I don't know how much you can see there in the back, but this is a so-called Paul trap. This big blob here is a vacuum chamber. And in the middle is a this black line here is the actual trap. Some electrodes are inside there. And these electrodes are what confine the ions. And the scale of all of this, actually, I'm not so sure. But as I said, the distance between the ions is on the order of several microns. That is 10 to the minus 6 meters. So this was stolen from the NIST website. Here is the web address. And you can check it out and find a lot more details about the experiment there. What I'm going to do today is give you a theoretical overview of how the ion trap proposal works. So this is a rough outline of the talk, not necessarily in this order. The big picture of what's going on is that the ingredients that we need are obviously ions, an electromagnetic trap, some lasers, and photodetectors, and that's pretty much it. You have these components, you assemble the trap as you saw in the previous picture. Why don't I keep showing that for you? And what I'll do in this talk is I'll tell you about what the qubits are, how we perform single qubit operations and two qubit operations, how we initialize the system, and how we perform our measurements. And when you can do these five things, that is, you have well-defined qubits, you can operate on them, you can initialize them, that is, you can input a state of your desire, and you can measure the outcome, that's basically what you need to construct a quantum computer. So I'll go over what these qubits are. They turn out to be so-called hyperfine states. I'll define that a little later. I'll tell you how the single qubit operations are done. Basically, they're laser-induced so-called Raman transitions between these hyperfine states. And the single qubit operations only involve these hyperfine states, which are combinations of electronic and nuclear states, and they do not involve the motional states of these ions. These ions can also oscillate in this trap. However, the two-qubit operations are done by coupling the ions through the so-called center of mass phonon. That is a collective oscillation in which all the ions are oscillating together, and this is used in order to transfer information from one ion to another. The initialization step is the act of cooling, lowering the temperature, such that the system ends up in its ground state, the lowest energetic state. And the measurement is an observation of fluorescence. that is of photons coming out when they when one of these hyperfine states decays to a lower state. Okay, so let me start by telling you in some more detail about the physical apparatus that we call the trap. So what you're seeing here is a scheme of what goes on inside this little blob here. What is the trap? Well, it consists of four electrodes in one configuration, not necessarily always like this. In this vacuum, there sits this string of ions. And when you think about it for a moment, you recall your undergraduate electrostatics class, you see that in order to trap a charged particle, you cannot do that with constant potentials, that is, potentials that are constant in time. There is a fundamental theorem of electromagnetism which prohibits that. So you need to find a trick which overcomes this this problem in order to trap these ions in a point in space. And the way you do that is by inducing an oscillating potential, oscillating in time. And what that potential does, basically, is it flips from a shape like this, that is, sorry, like this, a saddle point, okay, here's one way, into something that's rotated by 90 degrees. And it does that very quickly, this flipping. I can't really show you with my hands the whole act, but you go from this, oops, that's one thing, to the thing that's rotated by 90 degrees. And before the ion knows it, it's trying to fall down this side, but before the ion knows it, it's blocked by these high walls here. So by this quick flipping, you're actually able to trap the ions and overcome this theorem of electromagnetism. And that's the purpose of these oscillating potentials here. So that's how they can find the ions. Then you also have a laser, which you use in order to perform your logic operations. And you have a photodetector, which you use to perform your measurements. So the purpose of this trap is actually to provide horizontal confinement. As you see, I've drawn this in a line here, in what is otherwise a parabolic potential well. So what I mean by that is that if you write down the Hamiltonian, I'm going to talk more about Hamiltonians for computer scientists in a sec, but basically what's going on is that the Hamiltonian of this system, that is the energy of this system, consists of a potential energy, a kinetic energy term that is associated with the motion of the ions. And then this term is a harmonic potential where this is a three-dimensional harmonic potential, but the frequencies along the x and the y directions, that is the directions that are orthogonal to this direction, this is the z direction, these frequencies are much higher than the z direction frequency, which means that essentially these ions see a very steep wall in the x and y directions, whereas they're relatively free to move in the z direction. And the potential in the z direction is that of a harmonic well, a parabolic well. So in a sense, this is a very simple physical system. It's a system of a harmonic oscillator, a one-dimensional harmonic oscillator, to a good approximation. Now, these are ions, and as even a computer scientist knows, I hope.
Yeah?
They're in the Euclidean space. Z is this direction. Okay? The ions interact by a Coulomb repulsion. They repel each other because they're all, well, let's say negatively charged. So this repulsion is what is responsible for keeping them apart, of course. And if you tune the parameters of this well correctly, then you get this separation of the order of several microns, which turns out to be a good separation to have because that corresponds to, that is a separation which allows you to focus a laser, point a laser at a particular ion, such that the laser only interacts with that one particular ion and not with the others. Okay, so these are the ingredients of the trap. (Clears throat) And before I now delve into a more technical discussion of how we analyze the system and how we quantum compute with it, I want to just tell you why these ions are good. I mean, why even study the system in the first place? And the reason is, the short version of it is that they satisfy the DiVincenzo Bible. So the DiVincenzo Bible is a list of the DiVincenzo commandments, I should have said, is a list of five commandments which every quantum computer must satisfy. There must be well-defined qubits. Well-defined means that the Hilbert space of our qubit should be two-dimensional, which is pretty much true in the case of ions, although it's not perfectly true. Because these hyperfine states that we're going to use to define our qubits actually span a larger Hilbert space. But to a good approximation, you can actually confine the dynamics inside this two-dimensional Hilbert space, which is the one you want in order to have your qubits. The second commandment is the ability to initialize the qubit register. And as I already said before, you do this by cooling. I'll tell you in a minute in more detail how you actually cool and put your register in a standard state which we'll call the 000 state. The third component is the ability to read out the information, to make a measurement. And that is one of the greatest advantages of the ion trap. You can read out your information with phenomenal accuracy. 99% figures are pretty common. The fourth great advantage of the ion trap is the ability to control the individual ions, as I said before, by tightly focusing a laser beam, and the ability to couple the ions reliably. And that is done through this scheme which was invented by Bashir Akinzoller and later on improved by various people. So this is another extremely useful advantage of the ion trap, that you can do this in a relatively easy way. Probably the only other system in which this can be done as nicely as NMR. And finally, the ions have long decoherence times. The previous talk we heard about theory for quantum error correction. Of course, that theory is a theory of overcoming the problem of decoherence. And in particular, in the case of ions, the decoherence times are very long, at least for the hyperfine states. That is, they don't emit very readily, and a hyperfine state can exist coherently for as long as a second or so. And that you have to compare, of course, to how long it takes to perform a logic operation. There are at least three or four orders of magnitude separation there. So, for these reasons, the system of trapped ions is considered very good. And indeed, it's so far, after NMR, the system that has taken the greatest leaps in terms of experimentally demonstrating quantum computing. In particular, they have already demonstrated logic gates coupling two ions. They've entangled four ions, and they're working on, I'm sure they're working on taking this further to more ions and more complicated operations. Okay, so let me now get more technical. The PCS here means that physicists can sleep, and there will be more slides with that header. So this is for computer scientists. How do we talk about qubits in terms of Hamiltonians? Well, what's a qubit? It's a state. There's a zero state, there's a one state. They both have an energy, E0, E1. And let me call the energy difference h bar omega 0. So omega 0 is a frequency, and h bar is the famous Planck constant. So this quantity has units of energy. And as we heard in Mike Nielsen's talk yesterday, the Hamiltonian measures energy, which means that if I want to write down the Hamiltonian for this system, then this H0 is the Hamiltonian, acts on the zero state by multiplying by this number, E0, the energy. And likewise, the one state is an eigenstate of this Hamiltonian with an eigenvalue E1. So these two equations define the operator H0, define what our Hamiltonian is. You can immediately see that it's given by this expression here, the sum of these two projectors, 0, 0, and 1, 1. And that you can rewrite a little bit. in a useful form by introducing the sum of the 0, 0, and 1, 1 and the difference of the 0, 0, and 1, 1. That sum you can verify is the identity operator. The difference is the Pauli sigma z matrix. And since the identity operator commutes with everything, we might as well discard that term. Actually, all it does is defines an energy reference scale. So we can just write, without lots of generality, we can write this qubit self-energy term, or the qubit internal Hamiltonian, as 1 half h bar omega 0 times the operator sigma z. Okay, so you very often see that a Hamiltonian is written as something that's proportional to sigma z. This is the reason. And the second thing that we want to do with Hamiltonians at this level is to describe the process of absorption or emission on resonance. So here's your qubit again. And suppose that a photon comes in and that has a frequency of omega 0. Well, what this qubit will do typically is that it will absorb this photon. That is, it will go from the state 0 to the state 1, which is described by this line here. And the state 1 has nowhere to go. So in order to properly describe this, we say that the state 1 is annihilated under this operation, which gives rise to the operator sigma plus. Okay, and likewise, there is the reverse process of emission, where a photon comes out at this energy difference with the frequency omega 0. So now 1 goes to 0, the state 0 is annihilated. That we describe by the operator sigma minus. So a Hamiltonian which describes the qubit with its energy and its interaction with resonant radiation has this form. It's the sum of the energy term and these, and this would be the term that describes the interaction with this external, let's say, laser field, where I've introduced an energy scale here as well, h bar times this capital omega. Capital omega is often known as the Rabi frequency. And basically, it measures the strength of the interaction between this qubit and this external field. Okay, so now it's for the purposes of this talk, it's very useful to remember that the energy of the qubit is described by sigma z. And we have these two operators which are called sometimes raising and lowering operators. Sigma plus is a raising operator. It lifts the zero state to the one state, and sigma minus the other way around. So these are very useful operators to remember. They'll show up a lot. The second PCS slide I have is the quantum harmonic oscillator. We'll need that also to understand how an ion trap works. So very quickly, a harmonic oscillator is a mass m that's attached to a string. A string, let's say, has spring constant, has a spring constant k. And there is a kinetic energy term, a potential energy term. And what we do in physics is we quantize this energy by assuming that the position and momentum do not commute. This is the quantization rule. And now we have the Schrodinger equation. We can write down the Schrodinger equation in terms of this Hamiltonian. And it's very useful, turns out, to introduce two new operators, which are going to have the same meaning as I had before for sigma plus and sigma minus, but now in the context of a harmonic oscillator. This operator A is just, well, a constant times x plus I, constant times p. An A dagger is the Hermitian conjugate of A. A and A dagger obey this commutation relation, similar to x and p. And it turns out that you can then rewrite the Hamiltonian. That is, you can take this term after you quantize it and rewrite it in terms of A and A dagger. And this procedure is extremely useful because it tells you what's going on with the quantum harmonic oscillator. It turns out that A dagger A can be thought of as what's called a number operator. That is, if you define eigenstates, which are labeled by n, where n is just an integer going from 0 to infinity, then it turns out that this operator, acting on these states, pulls out the number n. So that means that the quantum harmonic oscillator is quantized in the sense that the energies can only be an integer multiple of h bar omega up to this correction here of 1/2. A correction of 1/2 is actually very interesting. If the harmonic oscillator is in the zero state, that is, there are zero quanta, it's in the lowest possible energy state, then it still has an energy, 1/2 h bar omega, and that's the so-called zero-point energy. It means there is still some motion going on, even though the harmonic oscillator is in the ground state. So schematically, you can write this, the potential, the 1/2 kx squared from up there, and you can draw these this energy diagram where when n is 0, it turns out that the solution to the Schrödinger equation looks like this. A Gaussian, when n is 1, it looks like that. When n is 2, et cetera, et cetera. So this is what a quantum harmonic oscillator is. Quantum harmonic oscillator has discrete energy levels. The energy levels are described by an integer that goes from 0 to infinity. And a very useful property to remember, again, similar to what we had for the qubit, is that these operators A and A dagger act as lowering and raising operators. That is, A, acting on an energy eigenstate, lowers the energy by one unit. In fact, if it acts on the ground state, it annihilates it. And A dagger acts the reverse. If you apply A dagger to an energy eigenstate, then it increases the energy by one unit. OK, so now the physicists can wake up. And we can go back to talking about ion traps. The first thing I want to talk about is the initialization step. That is the act of cooling. So why do we want to cool? Why is that the same as initialization? Well, when you lower the temperature, specifically you need to have a temperature which is very small compared to the energy scale of the oscillation along this z-axis. What happens is that the motion of the ions becomes quantized. In fact, the motion of the ions can be described just like the harmonic oscillator that I introduced before. So the motion of the ions can be described as a harmonic oscillator. That's as a quantum harmonic oscillator. That's the key property. In fact, this harmonic oscillator has a name. It's called a phonon. The ions move together as one particle, and this one particle has a mass of n is the number of ions times the mass of the individual ion, and it has these energies which are the solutions of the harmonic oscillator that I described before. So you can think of the motion of all the ions symbolically like this. There is a parabolic well, which is defined by this trap with the oscillating potentials that I described before. And this motion of the ions is quantized in the sense that at very low temperatures, you can think of the motion of all the ions together, that is this collective center of mass motion, as one particle that's just sloshing back and forth here. And when you increase the energy a little bit, that is, you raise the temperature a little bit, the amplitude becomes larger, et cetera, et cetera. And the goal of cooling is to go down to this motional ground state. That is, you want to put all the ions down here where they're moving with the zero-point energy, all together as one collective oscillation, as one big particle. Well, the truth is that there are all sorts of motions, all sorts of normal modes that can describe this ion string. So you can definitely also have ions moving apart or in all sorts of complicated patterns. But you can find out that the lowest energy motion is associated with this collective center of mass mode. Okay, and anything that involves some kind of a stretch motion has higher energy. And since we want to cool to the ground states for reasons that will become later on, I will only focus on the center of mass nodes. So how do we cool? I I won't say too much about this, but it goes in two steps. The first step is something called Doppler cooling, and the second step is sideband cooling. And Doppler cooling is the following neat idea. Suppose you're in the framework of this laser. You're sitting there in the lab with your laser, and you have an ion that's moving towards you and away from you. Well, if you remember the classical Doppler effect, then you'll remember that the frequency of this ion, in particular I'm talking about the transition frequencies between the, let's say, the one and the zero states, are slightly higher than for the ions that move away. That means that there is a mechanism for distinguishing ions that move to the left and to the right. And if you tune the frequency of the laser such that it is resonant with this frequency and not this lower frequency here, then only these ions which move towards the laser will absorb. And since a photon turns out has momentum associated with it, which is proportional to 1 over the wavelength of the photon, the ion will absorb this momentum and it will slow down. So by tuning these lasers resonant to the ions moving to the left, you can slow them down. And it turns out that this can actually help you to get to very low temperatures on the order of 1 millikelvin, 10 to the minus 3 Kelvin, using this method. It's limited by spontaneous emission from the ions. Once they spontaneously emit, then once again they can pick up speed, again from this recoil effect. So that's about as low as you can go there. So the next step you want to take, and this is how they actually do it in these experiments, is to use this method of sideband cooling. So sideband cooling, now we're going to use our knowledge of qubits as the zero and one states that are separated by energy and harmonic oscillator states, which are indexed by the integers going from zero to infinity. So I've written down here these kets, where the first index is the index of the qubit, the zero or the one, and the second index is the index of the phonon, of the quantum harmonic oscillator. And the energy diagram will look something like this. This is kind of a staircase. Now suppose that you tune the laser such that it is resonant with this transition, which means it's also resonant with this transition and this transition and all the other diagonal to the left ones. Well, if you apply this kind of a laser field, then, for example, here you will go from the zero, qubit 0 phonon 3 state to the qubit 1 phonon 2 state. And then the system will spontaneously emit, and it can only go in these along these three paths here. And that is true for all these diagonal pathways that we have, except for the 0-0 state. The 0-0 state has nowhere to go because there's nothing up here. So that means that everything just tumbles down like this, kind of a staircase, a ball rolling down a staircase, tumbles down to the 0-0 state. So that's how you put everything in the ground state. And notice that this is now both the qubit ground state, the 0 for the qubit, and the harmonic oscillator ground state, the phonon ground state. So this is how they cool down to this limit that we need to attain, where the temperature is small compared to the energy associated with the trap motion along the z-axis. And I believe, I couldn't actually find the actual numbers, but I believe this gets you down to probably 1 or 2 orders of magnitude below the millikelvin temperature. So this is cooling, and cooling is the initialization step of quantum computing. Okay, so once you apply this procedure, you have put everything in the zero state, and if we're talking about a bunch of ions, each ion representing a qubit, then all the qubits are now in this 0-0-0-0 state. Okay, so we've initialized our quantum register. Yeah. It should be a broad laser.
I guess my other question was, you can't read the laser separately because the phonon is the same phonon.
That's right. Yeah. So it's a broad laser.
One ion, all the other one will be cool. But you get rid of the phonon.
Get rid of the phonon
there. You can do it on a single.
Okay, I've talked about how you initialize your register, and now I want to talk about the qubits. So qubits are defined as certain hyperfine states. What's a hyperfine state? Well, there's way too much physics here to explain in 1 minute, so I'll just try to give you the flavor of it. A hyperfine state is a state that has a well-defined specific angular momentum, and that angular momentum comes from the nuclear spin, the electron spin, and the orbital of the electron. So we can think of spin as a special type of angular momentum, and there are rules for adding angular momentum, which are rather complicated and related to Clebsch-Gordan coefficients, etc. But you can add up these three contributions. These turn out to be the three important contributions in the case of these ions. So it's some, the qubit, as you see, is going to be some compound object which is related to the nuclear and the electronic degrees of freedom, specifically the angular momentum degree of freedom. And I'm going to call the collective angular momentum, which is associated with these three contributions, F. And then there is another part of the quantum of the angular momentum lore, which is that there are projections associated with this angular momentum, which are called the magnetic quantum number, and these projections run from minus F to F. I should say that that I, S, and L can be integers or half integers, and, as you will see momentarily in the example below. So the states that that can potentially serve as qubits are indexed by two numbers, this total angular momentum, the projection of the angular momentum. And it turns out that these states have excellent decoherence properties, which is the reason why they were chosen in the first place. That is, they have radiative lifetimes, that is, they don't emit photons for as long as seconds to even hours. Okay, so once again, this is one of the main reasons that this system was considered in the first place, because it is so stable against against this type of decoherence process whereby you move from one state to another through the emission of a photon. This is especially impressive compared to the time it takes to implement a logic gate, which is on the order of 10 to the minus 3 seconds. So you have plenty of time.
How does that compare to other candidate qubit systems for their
decoherence? NMR is comparable or maybe even better. The solid state systems tend to be terrible compared to this. So the ratio of the decoherence time to the logic gate time might be 10 or 100 at best. So this is really a very good property. Right. So specifically, in the experiments that use the species beryllium, a positively charged ion, it turns out that the nuclear spin has a value of 3 halves. The electron spin is always a half. And the electron orbital, in this case, has angular momentum 0. And then if you know the rules of adding angular momentum, then you know that, when you add these three numbers, there are basically two ways in which you can do it. You can add the 1 half to the 3 half, or you can subtract it, which means that the total angular momentum can be either 1 or 2. And then according to this rule that the projection goes from minus F to F, we have a total of 8 possibilities here, minus 1, 0, 1, or minus 2 all the way to 2. And it turns out that the qubit for this particular system has chosen to be these two states, where F is 1 and M sub F is 1, and F is 2, M sub F is 2. These are the two states that that they actually work with out of this manifold of 8 states. And now you can see why, when I said before that the qubit is well-defined but not terribly well-defined, where that comes from. Well, it's a little artificial to say that the qubits is just these two states. In fact, we have these other states to worry about, and there was a question yesterday, how do we pick D, the dimension of the Hilbert space? As Mike Nielsen pointed out, well, it depends on the physical circumstances. You see here that indeed it does. D really is 8, but we hope that we can stay within this subspace, this two-dimensional subspace, so that we really have a qubit. So, show this in more detail. This slide has the CSCS header, which means that computer scientists can go to sleep. because there's no way you're going to understand this, I think. this is the full energy level diagram of this ion. I've plotted these states all the way from F is 2 with MF minus 2 to F is 2 with MF is also 2. These states turn out to be lower in energy than these three states where F is 1. And I've circled here the qubit, the supposed qubit, where all the action is going to take place. And somehow we're supposed to prevent amplitude from leaking into this forbidden subspace here. And I've also indicated the phonon. Remember our phonon, the collective motion of all the ions together. The phonon actually makes this line split. Really, there are infinitely many levels here. But since our temperature is so low, we can actually ignore this infinity, and we can focus just on the phonon with zero quantum and one quantum. Okay, and likewise here. So all these lines really should be split to indicate the fact that a phonon is maybe present as well. And the energy scales are as follows. The separation between the F is 2 and the F is 1 manifold is in the order of a gigahertz. This is energy measured in units of frequency. A gigahertz is 10 to the 9 hertz, whereas the phonon frequency is only 10 to the 6. So you can see that this diagram is actually, the scale isn't very good, but it's very important to have this energy separation between the transitions between the qubits and the transitions between phonon modes. Okay, so to make it more complete, in fact, I haven't even told you the whole story for this energy level diagram. There are additional states, because the electron is not necessarily restricted to having orbital angular momentum of 0. It can also have orbital angular momentum of 1 and higher. So there are additional states, which are a lot higher in energy. And the single qubit operations, which I'm going to describe in some detail, are associated, in fact, with transitions through this state. So we don't actually connect the 0 and the 1 directly. In fact, we go this way. And the reason we do that, this so-called Raman transition, has to do with stability considerations for the laser pulses. But I don't want to get into that. So this gives you an idea of the complexity of saying that we have a qubit, right? It's not a very good approximation in reality. There's a lot of trouble associated with leaking to this church of the larger Hilbert space, as people like to call it. And the other line in this diagram is the measurement, how we actually perform a measurement. Well, it turns out there is another conveniently located state here, where F is 3 and M sub F is 3. And due to the selection rules of angular momentum and how photons interact with matter, it turns out that only this state, the 2-2 state, can couple here. Basically, the reason is that the difference between the M sub F here and here is 1, which is and whereas between here and here it's 2. So this kind of a transition is not allowed. So when you want to perform a measurement, what you do is you apply a pulse resonant with this transition. And if you observe fluorescence from this state, that is, if you now observe a photon that's coming out from here, then you know that your qubit was in the 0 state. But if you don't, then you know that your qubit was in the 1 state. And this is what I was referring to previously as a process that has 99% efficiency. So this is a very reliable way of measuring whether your qubit is either a 0 or 1.
The energy separation between the difference 2-2, 2-1, 2-0, et cetera?
That depends on the strength of the magnetic field that you apply. If you don't apply an external magnetic field, then they're actually going to be degenerate. Yeah. I'm not sure. I don't know if anybody
just
knows.
Wondering, yeah. You're going to get between them, so that
right.
Compared to the bigger.
Yeah.
Megahertz.
I don't know. Yeah.
Those are obvious because you go to the islands much farther apart than the
right. Yeah.
To be able to
That was for both, actually. Yeah. Okay. I'm not going to say anything else about measurement. So the take-home message about measurement is this is how you do it. But now I want to talk more about how we actually perform the single and two-qubit operations here. And you see from this diagram that this is really a very complicated system if you take all the details into account. So what we need is a convenient toy model. And what I'm doing here is actually I'm following the Mike book, to use Manny's term. If you want to read in detail about how this works, there's an excellent treatment of the ion trap as one of the chapters in that book. So how this works is the following. Our toy model, which will describe the ion trap interacting with the laser field, is here's the laser, here's a parabolic well, and here's our ion, which we're now going to approximate really as a qubit. So as a quasi-spin, as an object which can be either 0 or 1 or either up or down. The harmonic confining potential comes from the application of these oscillating electromagnetic fields. And the interactions that we have to worry about are the laser interacting with the ions, and the ions really are objects which split into these hyperfine states and phonons. Okay, so the hyperfine states interact with the phonons. And if you think about it for a second, then you might wonder, aren't there other arrows going back, let's say, from the phonons to the laser? Why is it that the interaction works only in this way? And the truth is that it also works in all these possible arrows can be connected, but there's a question of how strong the interactions are. And for a laser field that is sufficiently strong, contains sufficiently many photons, you can totally ignore the back action of the ions on the laser field. So we only need to worry about this direction of the interactions. Now, the Hamiltonian which describes this system is composed of two terms. There is the H sub 0 is the internal Hamiltonian, which I derived before, at least for the qubit. So that's the sigma z term. And then we have the phonon internal Hamiltonian as well, which I derived when I was talking about the quantum harmonic oscillator. So these two terms just describe the qubit by itself and the phonon by itself. And now we have the coupling of the qubit, the hyperfine states, and phonons with the external laser field. So the way that is described is the following. The ion can be described by a vector of polymatrices, sigma x, sigma y, sigma z, and that couples to the external magnetic field by just taking the scalar product. And the external magnetic field, we assume, is polarized along the x direction, moving along the z direction, so along the axis of the trap, with a frequency omega, and with a phase phi, and that phase is defined relative to, let's say, where the center of the trap is. So this is the interaction Hamiltonian that we're working with, and that Hamiltonian is supposed to give us the ability to control this system in such a way as to implement universal quantum computing. So to analyze this Hamiltonian, the first step is to remember that we're cooling the system, so we need to quantize the positions of the ions. That means that I take this z coordinate here. Z is the position of the ion inside the electromagnetic field, and I quantize it. If you remember the rule for writing down the A and A dagger operators, then you can check that A plus A dagger is really a coordinate. And the coefficient that comes out in front can be interpreted as the zero-point motion. That is, it is basically the spread of the wave function that describes the ion when it is in the lowest energy state here. So there are now two numbers that we should remember or worry about. One is the zero-point motion. How spread out the ion's position is in the lowest energy state, and the wavelength of the laser field. And when you take the ratio of these two, you get a parameter that's known as the Lamb-Dickey parameter, very important parameter in ion traps. And we want to assume that this ratio is very small. That is, the ion is highly localized compared to the spreading out of to the wavelength of the laser beam. And the second parameter that I want to define is the Rabi frequency, which is the product of basically it's a measure of how strongly the ion interacts with the electromagnetic field. So mu is a parameter describing the probability for a transition between the 0 and 1 states of the ion, and B is the amplitude of the electromagnetic field. So with these two parameters, and with the assumption that the Lamb-Dickey parameter, eta, is very small, you can now take this Hamiltonian, you quantize it, okay, you make Z an operator according to this description here, and what you end up with after making an approximation is the following Hamiltonian. And okay, it's the reason it's messy is because it's actually rather messy. So now I'm going to explain it. I didn't really keep track of when I started.
10 more minutes.
10 more minutes. Okay. So let's analyze this Hamiltonian. The bottom line is going to be the following. This term here we will use to do single qubit operations, and this term we will use to do two qubit operations. Okay, so how do we see that? The ion has two internal frequencies that we want to worry about. Frequency omega zero is basically the energy difference between the zero and the one state of the ion. Okay? And the frequency omega z is the frequency associated with the potential parabolic well and the motion along the z direction. So these are the two relevant frequencies. And as I showed you before, the transition between the 0 and the 1 state of the qubit is on the order of gigahertz, and the phonon frequency is on the order of megahertz. So omega z is much smaller than omega 0, which means that we only need to worry about these three terms here. The frequency must be positive, so we only need to subtract omega z from omega 0. These three frequencies are going to be the resonant frequencies for our laser. So we're only going to consider a laser that has either one of these three frequencies. Okay? And it turns out that if you apply a laser at the omega naught frequency, that is the frequency between the 0 and the 1 state of your qubit, then this big Hamiltonian just simplifies after making another approximation known as the rotating wave approximation, whereby you neglect certain small terms. And only the upper line here remains. So I've written it here again, and I've taken away this omega t term because omega, remember, omega is the frequency of the laser, and it's resonant with omega naught. Basically, that means that this term is going to go away. Okay, so this is the only thing that's left. And what it contains, you will now remember, the sigma plus and sigma minus operators. These two operators I talked about when I was talking about the qubit, these two operators allow us to make transitions up or down. And it turns out that having this kind of a Hamiltonian with controllable parameters, the controllable parameters are the Rabi frequency. Why is it controllable? Because it contains the amplitude of the electromagnetic field. So this is a controllable parameter. The phase angle, phi, is also controllable. It's just the phase of the laser the beam as it comes out of the laser compared to the position of the ions. So with these two controllable parameters, omega and phi, you can use this Hamiltonian to generate all single qubit operations. That is, you can generate SU2. S plus and S minus, sigma plus and sigma minus are the generators of the group SU2. So So this Hamiltonian all by itself can be used to perform any arbitrary single qubit operation. Now, yesterday when Mike Nielsen was talking about universal quantum computing, he introduced a certain set of gates which are universal, a certain discrete set of gates. I should add that another universal set of gates is the set of all single qubit operations with controlled knot or controlled phase. So the goal of the exercise here is to show that, well, we already have all the single qubit operations through this Hamiltonian. The next goal is to see how we can implement a controlled phase gate. That's somewhat non-trivial. And the way it's done is through the use of two other resonant frequencies, the omega 0 minus omega z and omega 0 plus omega z. And you can show, again, looking at this messy Hamiltonian, that the interaction Hamiltonian simplifies dramatically. At omega naught minus omega z, it has this form, which involves qubit up, phonon down. And this is qubit down, phonon up. Or this term where it's qubit up, qubit down, phonon down. Okay, so let's remember that we have this type of control in order to understand how to perform two qubit operations, in particular a controlled phase. So let me first give you the big picture of how we do this. It will turn out that these two Hamiltonians, which I emphasize again, to arrive at these Hamiltonians, all you need to do is you need to tune the frequency of your laser to be resonant with one of these two transitions. Okay, so that's the knob that you need to turn, the frequency of your laser. So it turns out that with these two Hamiltonians, we can implement two operations, two basic operations. A swap, exchanging the quantum states of the qubit and the phonon, let's say on the jth ion. Okay? So I've exchanged the state of the qubit and the phonon. And the phonon is a collective motion of everything. So that immediately couples through this phonon bus, so to speak, to, let's say, another ion over here, which I can then implement a so-called 2-pi rotation on, which is going to be equivalent to a controlled phase. So at this point, what's happened is we've swapped the state of the qubit with the state of a phonon. That information has traveled essentially everywhere. And now I apply a laser beam to this ion here, and I will implement a controlled phase operation on this ion. And then I do the reverse operation, whereby I swap back. And if you carry this analysis out in detail, you find out that there is a controlled phase gate which has been implemented here between the jth ion and the kth ion, which is a composition of the following three operations. Swapping the information between the jth qubit and the phonon, doing a controlled phase on the kth ion between the qubit and the phonon, and then once again a swap. And it turns out that this sequence implements a controlled phase between the jth and the kth qubits. Now, I'm afraid I don't have time to actually show this in detail. So let me perhaps show you just how the swap operation works. And you'll have to believe me about the controlled phase operation. So the swap operation is implemented by applying a laser with this resonance frequency. And then this is the Hamiltonian that we get from this long, complicated interaction Hamiltonian. We're only left with this term. And what is this term now? It contains a sigma plus, that is, qubit goes up, ion goes down with A. So I've drawn that here in the Hilbert space of the qubit states, which are in red, and the phonon states, which are in green. So this term, sigma plus A, takes the qubit up from 0 to 1, and the phonon down. And the opposite term takes the qubit down and the phonon up. That's this term here. So if you look at this diagram, you realize that what's going on here is indeed a swap operation. We've swapped the states 0, 1, and 1, 0. And actually, we haven't touched the states 0, 0, and 1, 1, but that's like swapping them. I mean, swapping inside. We haven't touched them. That's the correct way to say it. So this Hamiltonian implements a swap operation. And now if you want to implement such a swap operation in the lab, what you do is you turn this Hamiltonian on, so to speak. That is, remember from Mike's lecture yesterday, that if you exponentiate the Hamiltonian, you get a unitary operator. And that's what's actually realized as a quantum logic gate. So if you turn this on for a time that we call the pi pulse, that is, the time is pi over this coefficient here, then you can very easily show that this unitary operator takes this form in the Hilbert space of the qubit and the phonon. And this you may recognize as just a swap operator. But it's a very simple exercise to apply to these states and see that indeed they are swapped through this operator. So what's the bottom line here? In order to swap, you just apply a laser pulse at this frequency for a time corresponding to pi over this quantity. That's how you implement a swap. And the second ingredient is this controlled phase, and that you do with the other Hamiltonian. I won't go through the analysis here in detail. In fact, it's a little more complicated. You need to introduce yet more complication. That is, you introduce some auxiliary state. So we're actually using the fact that our Hilbert space is larger than just that of a qubit. And you go through the analysis, and it turns out that if you use this auxiliary state and you turn on your pulse for a time that corresponds to 2 pi, then that corresponds to a controlled phase operation. And then you apply this sequence. Okay, so apply a laser, a pi pulse to ion J. That implements a swap between the jth ion and the phonon. Then apply a 2 pi pulse to ion K. Then again apply the swap to ion J. Analyze that sequence. You will find that what you've gotten is a controlled phase operation between ion J and ion K. So this concludes the set of universal quantum gates, because we have all the single qubit operations, we have a controlled phase operation. And the important point to notice here that it all is made possible by this shared phonon, which is what couples the jth ion with the kth ion, essentially instantaneously when we perform these pulses here. So that's how we do universal logic. And I will conclude with just maybe criticizing this proposal, which is to say what I think the open questions are, if anybody's interested in working on this. Well, the main drawbacks are that actually cooling is rather difficult. But this is no longer an open question, because a couple of papers have shown what you need to do in order to compute with so-called hot trapped ions. So, sorry, that project is taken. Sorensen and Malmer wrote the paper which overcomes the cooling problem. There are a bunch of technical, kind of annoying technical problems which are associated with making these traps stable. It's very hard to actually prevent the appearance of higher harmonics. That is, saying that we are just dealing with center of mass phonons is not a good approximation. The potential well is really not parabolic. There are nonlinearities. there are corrections to this parabolic shape, and that introduces other motions of the ions which lead to decoherence. You can get zigzag patterns, I mean, keeping the ions in a straight line when you're trying to add more and more ions to this trap actually becomes very, very difficult. So the solution, you need to improve the trap. So that's an open problem. How do you improve traps? Probably for this crowd, not the most interesting problem. Very interesting problem is associated with the various decoherence mechanisms here. I already said that spontaneous emission is not a serious problem, because you get lifetimes on the order of a second or so. It turns out that a solvable decoherence problem, which initially was thought to be rather serious, is the problem that arises from random fluctuations due to external magnetic fields, or fluctuations in the laser power or the trap frequency. And in particular, the problem of fluctuating external magnetic fields was solved through one of the methods that Manny was talking about in the previous lecture, encoding into one of these noiseless or decoherence-free subspaces. And let me just flash this slide at you.